Greetings and welcome to another episode of Canadian History X. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can for as little as $3 a month. Just go to patreon.com/CanadaEHX. You can also donate to the podcast by going to CanadaEHX.com and clicking donate. Don't forget, I have two other podcasts out there, Bucks and Cups and From John to Justin. Both those podcasts are reaching the end of their run. So, I have two new podcasts coming. In May, I have Canada's Great War, where I look at the First World War from beginning to end, from home to France to England and everywhere in between. I also have coming in June, Coast to Coast, my look at the building of the Transcontinental Railway. Today, I'm speaking with Ryan Barnett. He's the man behind both a documentary film and a fantastic book about what a lot of people call the Atlantic Contiki. It's the true story of four men who crossed the Atlantic Ocean on a raft. And it's mostly forgotten today, and that's sad because it's an amazing story and it was a great book. So let's get right to my interview with Ryan. I guess the first question is, what kind of got you alerted to the fact that, and you do relate that in the book, but how you found out about the raft?
Well, I always had an interest in these kinds of stories. Like growing up, my favorite movie of all time, well, growing up it was, I've become more sophisticated as time is going on, but growing up it was Raiders of the Lost Ark. So if you start there, and then you go to watching Jacques Cousteau specials on TVO and that kind of thing, I've always been interested in this kind of world, these kinds of expedition stories, that kind of thing. And then in terms of Legarais specifically, I was doing my master's at Concordia, and I was doing a lot of papers. I was writing a lot of papers on stories. I wrote about the Contiki. I wrote about Frank Cole's film, Life Without Death. I was doing a lot of stuff of travel logs and ethnographic filmmaking. And then just one day I was driving in my car. I was doing a run. I was working on a TV show during the summer to make a little bit of money. And I heard a CBC story about Legarais. And that's how I first heard the story myself.
Now, it's not really known much in Canadian history, which is kind of a tragic thing because it's a fascinating story. Why is it in the shadow of Contiki? I mean, a lot of people know about Contiki, but so few Canadians know about this.
Yeah, well, I think one of the reasons is just the shadow of Contiki just looms so large. Mm-hmm. It's a similar story, although the details are very different. But I think that story is just so famous that anything that comes after it is just in comparison. When Legarais became famous in 1956 for the moment in which it was famous, it was actually dubbed the Atlantic Contiki. So even in the day, it was in its shadow. I think on top of that, you also have subjects at the center of it that don't really have a home. So Henri Baudu, the man who started the expedition, he was a French expat who had immigrated with his wife to Montreal. So he didn't really belong to France anymore. And he was an immigrant in Canada. And he felt out of place even within Quebec society, despite the fact that they had a common language, he didn't feel part of it. So I think, you don't have France claiming this story, you don't have Canada claiming this story, and you don't have Quebec claiming the story as their own. So there's really no one stewarding the legend of Legarais in any sort of meaningful way.
So what made you decide to mix the book with the historical account, but then also kind of mixing in like a graphic novel aspect to it?
Yeah. Well, the book actually started for me as a documentary film. So when I first approached Audie in 2012, I approached him on the basis that I was going to make a documentary film about not just the story of Legarais, but at the time, Henry was also in the process of trying to get a museum to rebuild his raft and put it somewhere so that it had some sort of a permanent home. Initially, the idea was to make a documentary that did the historical, but also did the contemporaneous story of what Henry was doing now. Just as I was finishing up the film, I think almost the same week that I was finishing up the film, I got a call from Firefly Books, and the owner, the publisher of Firefly, had heard the story and wanted to turn it into a graphic novel. And through a series of phone calls, it was relayed back to me that I was the, or it's relayed back to me that I was the expert on the subject. You know, I just spent 4 years working on this, right? So there was Henry, who's the only living member of the crew left, and then there was me. So Firefly engaged me to make a graphic novel, but graphic novels are very expensive. So we started talking about alternative ways to tell the whole story. And I had this documentary film that, you know, in the end, it was only 17 minutes long because, excuse me, it was only 17 minutes long because I wasn't able to film the rebuilding of the raft. So really it was a documentary that told the historical subject and the historical story only. So I had all this other material, all these other interviews, all this secondary source research, all these photographs that I wasn't able to incorporate in the documentary film. So I pitched to Steve Cameron, who was the editor at Firefly at the time. I said, why don't we do a paper documentary? Mm-hmm. And you know, we'll mix in, you know, prose writing, we'll mix in the actual news articles and any sort of primary documents we can have, so that if, you know, someone's really interested, they can read the material from back in the time of the journey. We can incorporate all the photographs, but also what was most important to me is that we can incorporate these other points of view that aren't reflected in the documentary and haven't been reflected in the telling of the story up to this day.
One of the tragedies of this is the fact that, you know, the boat, I think it was eventually turned into a fence and then was more or less lost to time. Do you think that if he, obviously when it happened in the 1950s, it's so close to Kon-Tiki, it's the Atlantic Kon-Tiki. If it had have happened, say, 5 years ago, would we have a different perspective on it? Would we maybe preserve that as a piece of history? Would it be more well known? Like, obviously at the time it was very well known.
Yeah, I don't think so. And the reason being, the Werner Herzog, the filmmaker, talks about how there's no possibility for exploration on Earth anymore. So people are becoming more and more niche in the way they carry out these endeavors. So that, you know, there's people that are peddling rafts made of trash across the ocean and things like that, right? So you know, it was covered in Russian paper. And German papers and you know, all languages, really. So it had its moment, but I think it goes back to that issue of it didn't belong to any, no, there was no like patrimonial pride in it because it didn't belong anywhere. So, you know, when they arrived in England, you know, as Henry tells it, the British made an offer to display it in London. But then there was overtures from Quebec to bring it back to Quebec, and they would put it on display in a museum in Quebec. And then when they brought it over, there was no museum to house it. So yeah, so as you said, you know, it spent its lifetime essentially in a field where kids played on it for, you know, a decade before someone used the wood for to make a fence to demarcate their property. So yeah, I think it goes back to that issue of it, no one felt like it belonged to them, so no one took care of it.
Reading it, one of the things I liked the most was the cats, although every time I was reading, I was worried that the cats were going to be swept overboard at some point in some great storm. But what was it like to research this and discover this story that so many people don't know about today?
What was it like to research it?
Or just to learn more about it and discover this this really cool tale of, you know, seafaring.
Yeah. Well, I mean, initially my intro to it, like I said, was that news story. And then I found one Globe and Mail article by the same journalist, Mary Wadden, who was working for the CBC at the time. But it, diving into it became really interesting because, you know, my initial, after those two news stories, I then called Henry and spoke to Henry, and then he was my conduit of, you know, what the story was of Legare. But then as you start to get the dates and you start to get the names, you start to look at the coverage of the time, and then you see that how that compares to Henry's version of it 60 years later, you know, and there's parts of the journey that he leaves out entirely. There's people in the journey that he'd rather, maybe this is not generous to say, but there's people in the journey that he's not as fond to talk about mm-hmm. as others. For instance, José Martinez, who was the cook of the Legado 2, you know, he was rescued off the ship 20 days into the journey. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Henry still to this day, I feel like he's still offended that José left, or he's still, there's still some sort of a hard feeling there. Mm-hmm. Despite at the time, you know, José was very sick at the time. He needed to get off the raft. But, you know, I think that's been the really rewarding thing is that, you know, I know Henry's version of it, but now I also know people like Rosemary Comeau, or Rosemary Marr, as she's with her married name. She was the secretary for the team when they were in Halifax. She did all the translation for them, helped them source material, all that. Her story hasn't really been told anywhere. It's been kept with her, and she's told it to her kids and her friends mm-hmm. and that, but it's never been part of the published record. It's never really been anywhere. So that's been one of the most rewarding things, is being able to kind of insert these other points of view in there to fill out Henry's story.
Mm-hmm. What's Henry like? I mean, obviously he did this journey across the ocean. Yeah. He was involved with, I believe it was the French Resistance.
Yep.
And then he did a whole bunch of other sailing expeditions. Like, he's lived more in his life than like you and I probably combined could. So what is
you
he...
don't know my life story.
Well, I know mine. So what's he like? Obviously, you know, he's into his old age now, but
yeah,
what
he's
was
still
it like meeting him?
Intimidating. to be totally honest with you. I've known Henry now for 9 years. And I don't think I can go 2 weeks without him calling me. like, that's about the longest time between phone calls. Mm-hmm. He's unstoppable. And he's very good at like pulling people into his cause. So after knowing him for this long and knowing how like he makes contact there and he makes a contact there, and you know, oh, this guy can provide us with this, or this person wants to do a story there, or you know, you see how kind of people gravitate towards him and how he's able to not in a pejorative sense, but leverage that for his own agenda. Mm-hmm. You understand how he did this all, not just once, but twice. Cause you know, because there's a Legado 2, there is a Legado 1, mm-hmm. which, you know, is a whole other story. So there's that aspect of him. So the guy that makes you want to come on board and, you know, become part of his project. And he's just, you know, he's 90, what was it? He would be 98, I think, mm-hmm. 90, somewhere around there. And, he's still like full of energy. I don't see him as often as I used to now because of COVID. Mm-hmm. I haven't been able to spend time with them. Usually I see him at a door if I have to, like we have the French version of the book coming out next week. And you know, we had to proof the French version and all that. So he and I had some interactions through a doorways as I gave him proofs and he gave me his corrections and all that stuff. But yeah, he's still at, you know, at 98 years old, he's still unstoppable. He's still planning, still trying to figure it out. He just asked me, because he has the 16 millimeter film footage of the trip, and he was asking me to find him a place that could digitize it for him. Mm-hmm. And just like, okay. Yeah, okay. I can do that.
Looking at the story, like one aspect I like is that you had these people from France. They immigrate to Canada, they find a new home in Canada, and then, you know, they embark on this great journey. And like you said, it's kind of hard, like no country could really claim it because it was Frenchmen living in Canada sailing to England. But do you think now we should be, as Canadians, kind of claiming this as like this great accomplishment that essentially Canadians you know, did accomplish, and maybe rediscover it more through things like your book and the documentary?
Well, yeah, I mean, I would hope so. I mean, certainly it's never been a barrier of acceptance for me, whether they were from France initially, or whether they, you know, or French speaking or whatever. That's never been an issue for me in taking up the story. But I will say, in all honesty, I think if you were to ask Henry this question, he still feels that resistance, you know, in looking at places that might be able to recreate the raft and you know, and put it in their institution, there was a lot of no's. He eventually got a yes, but there were a lot of no's. You know, for one reason or another. And even when he was able to do it, it wasn't a permanent exhibition. It was a temporary 2-year exhibition that was then meant to travel. And I don't honestly know how much traveling it's done, but I don't think it's done a ton.
Looking through the book and reading through the book, there's a lot of great stories. I especially liked whenever they'd come across a ship and they'd have to more or less explain to the captain of the ship that we don't need to be rescued. You know, this is something we're trying to do. And the story of the shark that they caught that they really couldn't eat because it tasted terrible. Yeah. But was there any stories that really stuck out for you that you really liked from the journey?
In preparation for this, I reread the book, which I hadn't done in English probably since it was published. And what stuck out to me is when they were fantasizing about where they might end up. You know, it's an anecdote taken out of the autobiography that Mark wrote years later, and they talk about where they want to land, and they're imagining maybe that they might land in Ireland, and they're like, oh, Ireland will be great, you know, we'll be fed, we'll be given cream, and you know, it's all green there. And Mark has a line, I'm gonna have to paraphrase it. Mark has a line about how the women's skin is dotted with sunshine, and how he'd like to get a nice tan under that sunshine or something like that, which I thought it was just like just such a funny thing for like a 29-year-old guy to say after being on a ship for 40 days with with two guys.
Understandable. There's two ships, and then obviously the first one, they hit a lot of trouble. They start, you know, they're sailing up the St. Lawrence, which they decide next time we're not going to do, leave from Halifax. Do you think that we would have had the second boat without somebody like Henry, who is so committed to this vision that he has of sailing across the Atlantic?
Yeah, no, I don't think so. I think for example, Henry, there's four raftsmen on that first raft, and two of them decided not to take part in the second one. So right there, you have 50% of your crew gone. but Henry also tells it as the minute he was watching his ship essentially sink or break apart in the choppy waters, it was there that he decided that he has to do it again, because I think just because he took so much crap from people in the first place to put the expedition together, that he just didn't want all those people to be right. And, you know, you talk about the first expedition. The first expedition, they were 60 some odd days out, and they hadn't even really gotten past Newfoundland. and it was planned to be a 100-day journey. So, mm-hmm. I feel like they were almost blessed that they wrecked, because it's certain that journey wouldn't have made it across the ocean. They just would not have made it. Because it would have been, what would it have been? It would have been a 140-day journey. Like, that's just...
It's not going to happen.
It's not going to happen.
I also got to say that Henry has a very understanding wife who, you know...
I can't believe it.
Yeah, like, to be able to do this not once, but twice. And like, you know, that's amazing to me.
No, I really can't believe it. And that Janine's such a lovely woman. She's so like, to this day, she still gets birthday and Easter presents for my daughter. And she's so lovely. And I just don't know why she let him. If you ask her, she just says, well, like, what am I going to stop him? Like, that's basically what she says. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. And you know, when I was initially making the documentary and we were talking about rebuilding the raft and all that, people kept asking me, are you going to sail the raft after that? And I was like, no. And and that was before I was married with a child. Now I'm married with a child. Like, no, hell no, I'm not doing that.
Not going to happen.
But it also shows you the state of mind that Henry was in, that, that, you know, this expedition became so necessary to him that he's either willing to risk that, or he believed in himself so much that, mm-hmm. that failure was just not a consideration for him.
Absolutely. And then just the last question is, where can people find the book, find you, learn more about it, if they have questions, anything like that?
Where can you buy it? You can buy it anywhere where you find books. So the English edition has been out since October 2017. It's available through Firefly Books. You can get it on Amazon or however you order your books. And the French version, which is being published by Edition Glénat, is going to be out on April 7th. And again, you can buy it anywhere that you can buy books. And if you want to know more about me, I have a production company called Knockabout Media based here in Montreal, and you could just go to knockaboutmedia.com.
I hope you enjoyed that interview. And if you did, please leave a rating and review. If you like, you can reach me through email at craig@canadaehx.com. You can also visit my website. You will find hundreds of articles on Canada's history, as well as all my podcast episodes. Just go to canadaehx.com. And don't forget, you can support the podcast through Patreon. There are multiple tiers to choose from, all with great benefits. You can support the podcast for as little as $3 a month, just like all of these wonderful patrons have, and I apologize if I mispronounce any names. Doug Campbell, Reg W, Deborah Carlson, Francis Helbling, Randall McCallum, Diane Wade, Laurie Ann Kirby, Gary Dolovich, Nick Zinri, Shannon Marshall, Clinton Martinez, Dimitri Chauve, Aaron O'Hara Myers, Robert Dunseith, Todd Casey, Catherine Rawa, Luke S., J.P. Bear, Jason Hall, Phil Maynard, and Iris Gray. If you want, you can find me on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/CanadianHistoryX. You can find me on Twitter. My handle is Craig Baird, CraigBaird. And you can find me on Instagram. Just go to Bairdo37. Thanks. We'll see you again next time.